It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered! Oh!
You like fighting a woman?
You got grown-ass wrestlers in the back going on Twitter.
Come over here and fight me.
Oh my God, we're only an hour in.
You have legs.
We have two more hours of this.
I was 99% positive it was just chest up.
No.
I want out of my contract if I don't get what I want.
Welcome to episode 849 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off. It is Sunday, February 18th, 2024. I am the Solo Monster. Less than a week away from the Elimination Chamber. We got WWE news to talk about. AEW Revolution coming up in a few weeks. The card has come into focus a little bit more. We'll talk about that. We got some more on the fallout of Scott D'Amore's firing from TNA. And I got some thoughts on old Dave Meltzer. It was not a good week for Dave. We'll get into that as well. And I got a ton of questions from you guys. Let's just get into it here. Let's get into it. But first, before we get into it, though, I got to say thank you to our PayPal producers for this week. Again, you can always make a donation, completely voluntary. You can go to thesolomonster.com. You'll see the PayPal link at the top of the page. Happy birthday to Sherrod Big Daddy Boyd, who celebrated a birthday on Monday. I hope you got everything you wanted. You're getting this podcast, right? This is my gift to you. The Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, Big B Brian Becerra, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine Harrison Soep, Carlos Man of Steel Manuel, The Chicago Slayer Willie Eicher, Night Stalker Nayef Alsafar, Killshot Keith Hart, New York Punk Arnold Modesto, Undeniable Samantha Turner, and Dangerous Dan Bassey. Thank you for the support. Very much appreciated. Also, top 10 wrestling shows on all of Apple Podcasts this week for the second week in a row. Thank you for that. Let's try to make it three in a row. Let's start with WWE here. The Rock and Roman Reigns were back together on SmackDown Friday night, and I was curious to see how Rock would respond to the digs that Triple H took at him the week before. And Paul Heyman even walked into Triple H's office later in the show. Remember, he said, "Oh, you're in a bad mood. I'll come back later." He said, "Actually, I'll come back next week, and I'll be bringing Rock and Roman with me." And Triple H told him, "I look forward to it." But there was no Triple H on Friday. It was completely ignored, at least for now anyway. I assume it will not be ignored going forward, but it was completely ignored this week, which was kind of weird. What we did get was a hybrid mix of Attitude Era Rock with the $500 silk shirts, and Hollywood Rock with the leather vests. We got Rock wearing a Versace vest. It's like literally, if you just kind of fuse the two of them together, this is what you would end up with. He was out there on Friday night playing the greatest hits, calling the fans of Utah the biggest collection of trailer park trash he's ever seen, giving them a story that they and their 50 wives can tell their 600 inbred grandchildren one day. That cracked me up. It was classic heel Rock, which was a nice little dose of nostalgia. There wasn't much else to it. He was trying very hard to make sure the crowd booed him, which they mostly did. At one point, they did start chanting Rocky. And he used a sports analogy about Cody Rhodes that made no sense. He's talking about the 49ers losing to the Chiefs in the Super Bowl last weekend and not whining about it. They took their lumps like men. Michael Jordan beating the Utah Jazz back in the day. You already lost to Roman Reigns last year. Now all of a sudden you want a rematch. That's your story? That's not how life works. Well, actually, that's how the Royal Rumble works. You win and you get to challenge the champion at WrestleMania. I know Rock's been gone for a while, but he won one of those matches at one time. You'd think he would know that. Chalk it up to a heel saying heel things, I guess. But I laughed when he talked about that not making any sense and how stupid that logic is. When you can say the exact same thing about Cody stepping aside in the first place to let Rock take the match with Roman Reigns. None of it makes sense. It's par for the course with this storyline so far. But here we are. You know, heel Rock is far more entertaining than the pandering Rock that we got with Jinder Mahal last month. I'll take this Rock over that Rock. So this is a plus. Now all we need is Stone Cold to come back. Give Rock a stunner at WrestleMania. You know what's eerie? We were having a discussion in the live chat on Friday night about theme music. Because we went off on this tangent about theme music, and I mentioned Stone Cold's Disturbed theme, which was a fantastic theme, I think his best one. The very next morning, what do I see on my Instagram timeline? A reel from Steve Austin with his Disturbed Titantron and theme that he had just posted on Saturday morning. Now that's eerie. But I'd love to see it. Just go full on Avengers and just bring them all back. You know, Rock and Austin together one last time for old time's sake. We're in a better place now than we were before, now that Roman and Cody is official for WrestleMania. Still no clarity on what role Rock is actually going to be playing on the show, but he did promise to use his power to make sure that Cody leaves WrestleMania a loser, just like he did last year. Will he make himself the guest referee for their match? Will they do a tag team match on night one with Rock and Roman against Cody and Seth? That seems plausible, very plausible, given that Cody and Seth are going to be guests on the Grayson Waller Effect at Elimination Chamber next weekend. Cody and Seth together means they got something cooking here. But when the segment was over, I said this on Friday, I was left with the feeling that Rock is absolutely going to, in some form or fashion, help Cody Rhodes win that championship at WrestleMania. It may be Tyson and Austin all over again. And then you guys pointed out a couple of things to me that I did not pick up on the first time. So I went back and I watched the segment two more times. The first thing was Rock pointing in the direction of Roman Reigns and the camera switching to a different angle to show Rock pointing over in his direction. Roman, meanwhile, his head is turned towards the crowd, so he didn't see it. At the same time, Rock said that he would do everything in his power to make sure that he left WrestleMania a loser. Now, the reason I didn't think anything of it was because he very clearly was addressing Cody Rhodes when he said that. He even started out by saying, Cody Rhodes. And then he said he would do everything in his power to make sure he walked out a loser. Could it have been a little Easter egg? It's possible. It could also be that people are looking way too much into this. It happens all the time. Right, with movie trailers and things like that, you look for things that aren't necessarily there. Sometimes they are. That camera switch is what stood out because it was the only part of that last little bit of the promo where the camera changed angles. And it was this weird side angle that they don't usually use. Like, there was no reason for them to do that. They quickly cut right back from, you know, what they were showing there in those 3 seconds back to a tight shot of The Rock, which is what they had for the majority of the segment. But it just so happened to switch at the exact moment that he pointed in Roman's direction. So yes, I could see that being intentional. And then at the end, when all the members of the Bloodline put their fingers up in the air, Rock threw up what looked like an L for loser. Was that him sending a signal that the Bloodline would be a loser at WrestleMania? He called Cody a loser, so it could have been as simple as that. But people are reading into all these different cues. Maybe they're giving them too much credit. I told you that I thought Rock was helping Cody, and that's before I went back to see any of this. I didn't need any Easter eggs to tell me that Rock is probably fucking over Roman Reigns at WrestleMania. Rock also said, Cody, your story is just ending. Our story, as in him and Roman, is just beginning. Cody's story is ending at WrestleMania because he's going to win the WWE Championship and finish his story. And when he does, the story between Rock and Roman can then begin. Or at least move on to the next chapter. So where my head is at right now, I don't think we're getting heel Rock beyond WrestleMania. Enjoy it for now, because I think come Mania, this goes one of two ways. Either this whole thing ends with Rock and Cody in cahoots, right from the start. They could even tie it back to that hug in the ring a few weeks ago when Cody stepped aside. We still don't know what that was about. We don't know what Rock whispered in his ear. They could still make sense of that if they want to. It was all part of the plan to weaken the Bloodline and weaken Roman's grip over them. And come Mania, if Jimmy or Solo try to get involved, which you know they will, they can get taken care of by The Rock. Or Rock orders them to stand down because he has seniority. Cody beats Roman. Roman not only loses his title, but as Cody said to him previously, he wants him to lose everything. Roman loses the bloodline too, not just his title. And so begins the build to Rock and Roman at WrestleMania 41. The other way they could play it is that there is no grand conspiracy. They do a tag team match on night one, and Rock wins it for the bloodline. Roman loses the next night, though. Rock represented the bloodline. Roman disgraced it. And then he gets excommunicated from the group, and they can start the Roman Reigns babyface turn. And remember, I had even thrown in the idea that maybe Jacob Fatu pops up in all this. Maybe on television later that week when they actually put a beatdown on Roman or something and Fatu debuts in WWE as, you know, almost like his replacement. Not that he would replace him as like the top star in the company, but just if you want to keep the bloodline faction going and Roman, let's say, takes some time off, Fatu's a free agent, right? I'm just saying he would be, you know, if you slide him in there, it would be perfect. So that was another kind of aspect to the story that I had floated. Because when this is all said and done, even if it's not until next year's WrestleMania, the end goal of all of this should be ultimately to turn Roman Reigns into a massive babyface. But I watched that segment on Friday and I saw Rock standing there in the vest and putting his finger up in the air. It may as well have been a fist. You know, I mean, it took me back to those days when he would pump his fist up in the air back in the Nation days. You know, but here's the thing, it hit me in that moment. Rock is no follower. He's too big to follow anyone or be anyone's equal or be in anyone's shadow. Roman's out there saying tonight is historic because The Rock officially joins the bloodline. Like Rock is falling in line. Like he's Jimmy or Jay. He was completely full of himself. That is going to prove to be his downfall. The other thing with Rock, in these two appearances where he and Roman have been side by side in Vegas and now in Salt Lake City, and it's been really noticeable to me, is just how much of a background player Roman feels when he is out there with The Rock. It's the little brother thing. You know, Roman calls Seth his little brother. Roman is little brother when he's out there with Rock. And he is. I mean, Rock is a much bigger star than he is, but they gotta walk a fine line there. Unless ultimately it feeds into the story and it's all part of the story, you know, maybe over these next few weeks, Roman feels it too. He feels like he's being overshadowed, and Rock takes on more of a leadership role, maybe on the bloodline, and that doesn't sit well with Roman. Maybe things start to get a little dicey between them. I mean, Rock wants everybody to acknowledge him as, you know, Roman rather, wants everybody to acknowledge him as the tribal chief. Not only has Rock not acknowledged him, he didn't even call him that on Friday. He called him my cousin. My cousin, Roman Reigns. I can't see that shit flying with Roman if he keeps doing that. So again, there's a few different ways for this to go, and I'm interested to see what they choose to do. But I want to talk about Dave Meltzer. And thanks, by the way, to the guy who literally copied my tweet about this word for word and posted it as his own on Reddit. Someone sent me a screenshot of it. You're welcome. I don't want to beat up on Dave too much. You know, The Observer, for many years, was the source of pro wrestling news. If you were a fan who wanted to know about the goings-on behind the scenes, and obviously if you were a talent, too, because they would pass this thing around all the time, you hear stories about it, and guys would try to hide it when they were in the locker room, but, you know, everybody was reading it. I don't get too hung up on the star rating stuff the way some people do. But it was always The Observer and The Torch. Keller's been doing this since 87. Meltzer for even longer than that. Those old observers are a helpful resource to have, especially for historical content. Unfortunately, there are not many wrestling archives as detailed and readily accessible as those old observers because the wrestling news, you know, reporting bubble, it just isn't very big. It's bigger now than it used to be for sure. But back in the day, you had the magazines, many of which were kayfabed, and you had the dirt sheets. Hulk Hogan even burned a copy of The Observer on a WCW pay-per-view once. And there is still good information in those newsletters. I think it's unfair to dismiss everything the man says these days as nonsense, because that's become kind of the in thing to do. But it's weeks like this that make it hard not to see why people feel that way. I don't know what the fuck happened this week. He's still clinging to this notion that Rock against Roman was locked in for this year's WrestleMania as far back as the beginning of January, yet in the same breath, he admits that he has no answer as to why they had Cody Rhodes win the Royal Rumble if the plan was always for The Rock to wrestle Roman Reigns. Because it wasn't the plan until Rock suddenly wanted it to be. That's why it doesn't make sense. Rock decided he wanted to do the Roman Reigns match now, and it blew everything up. Thankfully, he had enough sense to course correct. But then Dave went completely off the deep end, and he put something in this week's newsletter. It just defies all logic. And it has since been edited out. It's been deleted. But he wrote, and I quote, at the Mania press conference on February 8th in Las Vegas, Levesque talked about guys going into business for themselves with the idea that Rock was going against the planned script. Later, they filmed a segment which did not air on television but was all over social media where Levesque and Rock went nose to nose and actually challenged each other for a match at Mania, although it was that they would love to wrestle each other before a giant crowd at a WrestleMania without the idea that it was this specific one. Given Levesque's heart issues, such a match would seem to be impossible, and virtually everyone believed that to be the case. Reading that, I thought that I had totally lost my mind, because I don't recall anything like that happening. I saw the same segment that you did at the end of that press conference, where they had a run-in backstage, and Rock told him to fix things, and if he didn't fix things, he and Roman were going to fix it for him. But nowhere did they come nose to nose and challenge each other to a match at WrestleMania, but that did seem awfully familiar to me. And the reason it sounded awfully familiar to me is because it sounded a lot like a segment the two of them had, which did air on SmackDown, 10 years ago. Actually, they filmed it at Raw in Brooklyn that week. That was the night that Rock confronted Rusev and Lana, and then they aired it on SmackDown. I think it was the 15th anniversary that week. That was the first tease they did for a possible WrestleMania match between them. And then at WrestleMania the following year, they had The Rock and Ronda Rousey confronting Triple H and Stephanie with the idea that they might do either a mixed tag or they might do Rock against Triple H in Dallas the following year, but it never happened. So how in God's name did Meltzer mistake a segment from 2014 as something from 2024? You would think the 2K15 poster on the wall behind them would have been a dead giveaway. Like, how does that happen? We're not talking about a typo. Typos, I understand. I mean, this guy is writing 40,000 words every single week. I can understand a typo. But this is not that. How does that happen? How does this man not have an editor to catch things like this? I mean, this is still not as bad as doctors taking Shibata's brain out of his skull and putting it back in. But it's pretty damn close. Next week, he's going to be telling us that Triple H was miraculously cleared for a match with The Rock, but he couldn't understand why they did it on SmackDown, and why Shawn Michaels superkicked Rock in the face, and seems to have grown his hair back in. But that wasn't the only thing this week. I mean, that was bad enough. If it was just one thing, alright, whatever, you want to chalk it up to a bad day. He reported that Tommy Dreamer was the new head of TNA Creative after Anthem fired Scott D'Amore within hours. This was refuted by Dreamer himself on Busted Open and by Mike Johnson on PW Insider. And I'll have more on that later. He reported that as part of Tony Khan's deal with CMLL, no other Mexican wrestlers, regardless of whether they're affiliated with AAA or not, because CMLL and AAA, they don't play nice together, that no other Mexican wrestlers can appear on the same show. But if that were true, they already violated their own agreement on the very first show that the CMLL stars appeared on. Because the night that we first saw them storm the ring was the night that Commander, who's a AAA guy, wrestled Wardlow. Fightful Select, when they asked about this, they said they got pushback on that report. Yeah, no shit. From people within AEW. Because it's understood, like, CMLL and AAA talent, they say, cannot be booked against each other. That would probably start World War III. But what Dave said in that report, it just doesn't make any sense. He reported last week that the morale backstage in AEW was the best that it's been in a long time. But then this week, he said that while he did report that, there's actually a lot of frustration over people flying in for these shows and then not being used because they have so many people on the roster. So I guess morale, maybe the high morale only lasted 1 week, I guess. It isn't just a case where, you know, maybe with the new regime at WWE, he doesn't have the same sources he once did. That may be true. That may be true. But we're not just talking about WWE here. He got things wrong with AEW and with TNA, all in the same week. He had to apologize last year for reporting false information about Dragon Gate that he claimed was a hoax that came from a couple of people who didn't actually work for Dragon Gate or who were pretending to be somebody that they weren't. This went on for an entire year. At least he fessed up to it and he said it wouldn't happen again. But that was embarrassing. But the worst of all is he again repeated falsely in this week's Observer that Ashley Massaro, in her email to WWE after the concussion lawsuit got dismissed, apologized to WWE for the things she said. That is just demonstrably false. I read the email, okay? It takes 5 seconds to look up the email because WWE shared it publicly a few years ago after her death. What she apologized to them for was allowing herself to be poached by her attorney to be part of the concussion lawsuit, and that she should have consulted with them first before agreeing to be part of it. To read what Dave writes makes it sound like she apologized to them for everything she said in her affidavit, which includes the story about her being raped and WWE wanting her to keep quiet about it. That is absolutely nowhere to be found in that email. And I think that's a pretty important distinction to make. But I'm not a journalist. I'm just a podcaster here, so what do I know? You know, it's one thing for Dave to be wrong about a creative plan or Shibata's brain. I'm worried about Dave's brain. I don't know if it's that he's overworked or a laziness to double and triple check things or just an outright refusal to accept reality, but he's been doing this long enough that he should know better. Speaking of Ashley Massaro, one of her best friends, Kara Pipia, was a guest on News Nation this week and backed up Ashley's claims that WWE did not want her to report her sexual assault in Kuwait in 2006. For those who may have missed it, I talked about this at length last week in a sworn affidavit, part of which I read on the show last week after she came home from that trip overseas back in 2006. Ashley claimed that Vince McMahon, in a meeting with WWE executives, urged her not to disclose the incident because it would ruin the company's relationship with the military. Don't let one, you know, bad incident ruin our whole, you know, positive relationship that we have with the military. Pipia said that Ashley told her about the meeting with the executives, saying that there was no compassion, there was no sympathy from the company, that they had Stephanie McMahon talk to her beforehand because she was a woman, to make Ashley feel more comfortable, but once she walked into that boardroom, she was on her own completely. And when asked if she believes what happened to Ashley in Kuwait contributed to her suicide, Pipia said 99%, absolutely. Now, we don't know for sure, we can never know for sure, because unfortunately we can't ask her. But this woman was one of Ashley's best friends. You know, on her social media, you see photos of them together over the years, even from when they were kids, right on up through what had to be not long before Ashley died. So this is not someone out of the woodwork claiming to know her who really didn't. This is clearly somebody that she was very close to. And she would know better than you or I what she may have been going through or how it may have affected her. Because a traumatic experience like that is not something you forget. You don't just kind of wave your hand and say, well, that's in the past and that's the end of it. It wouldn't surprise me at all if it played a role in her taking her own life. This is the first time that Stephanie's name has been invoked in any of this, but not the first time that Stephanie's name has been invoked by Ashley. As I talked about last week, there was more than one occasion after she started with the company where she asked if she could train elsewhere on her days off because she was never properly trained. She didn't know what she was doing. She kept getting hurt. And she claimed that Stephanie, on more than one occasion, told her no. She had started training anyway on her days off, I think with Mikey Whipwreck. The company got wind of it and told her to stop. Exactly what Stephanie knew about her attack at the time that Ashley walked into that meeting, only Stephanie can answer that question, and she doesn't work there anymore. But this whole thing stinks to high hell. Fightful Select had a note, thought was very interesting, that they had been in contact with Ashley in March of 2019 to set up an interview in Las Vegas that May at StarCast. That was the StarCast where Undertaker and Kurt Angle had agreed to appear until WWE found out about it and then pulled them. She was hoping to talk about her plans to return to the ring because she had just, I think, fairly recently before she passed away, she had started training for an in-ring comeback. She was going to talk about that. But they said she was weighing whether or not to open up further about her assault claims from the tour in Kuwait. But then she died. Now, the report said she died 2 weeks before StarCast. It was actually 1 week. It was exactly 1 week before. StarCast kicked off on the 23rd. Ashley died on the 16th. And Fightful also says they've spoken to one former WWE talent who has indicated that they are weighing whether to tell their story through the media or whether they want to go take legal action instead. This is not a story that is going away anytime soon. Elimination Chamber is coming up next Saturday from Perth, Australia, with a 5 a.m. start time here on the East Coast. Here's what I'm thinking, and chime in and let me know if this sounds good to you. I'm not sure what kind of audience there would be, honestly, at 8:30 in the morning or 9 o'clock in the morning for a live review. So I'm thinking of going live around noon, or sometime between noon and 1 p.m. that day, on YouTube to talk about the pay-per-view. So that's what I'm leaning towards doing, especially if I'm going to be live the night before after SmackDown. I know I'm not going to get to bed until late. And just pulling an all-nighter when I still have a podcast to prepare for on Sunday, that don't work for me, brother. I mean, what are you trying to do, kill me? I say we go live around lunchtime next Saturday and just break it all down. So let me know what you think. It's tough to do predictions without even knowing all the participants in the Women's Chamber match. That'll be decided in a last chance battle royal on Raw tomorrow night. If Jade Cargill is in it, then she's winning it and she's advancing to the chamber. But I don't know if she'll even be in the battle royal. You know, a lot of it comes down to whether or not they want her in the chamber at all, if she's not going to win it. She was in the Royal Rumble and she didn't win, but she still looked great. So there's always a way to include her in that. Maybe even let her eliminate a couple of people, but then she falls to someone else. It's possible. Right now, the lineup for the Women's Chamber is Becky Lynch, Bianca Belair, Liv Morgan, Naomi, and Tiffany Stratton, which is a hell of a lineup. It almost doesn't matter who fills that final spot, though. I've got Becky Lynch against Rhea Ripley as the match at WrestleMania. Rhea is defending her Women's World title against Nia Jax. That's a win for Rhea. Anyone betting against her on that show is a fool. Pete Dunne and Tyler Bate challenge Finn Balor and Damian Priest for the Undisputed Tag Team titles. I don't see the Judgment Day dropping the titles on this show. The only reason I would not rule it out completely is if they wanted to do Balor against Priest at WrestleMania. Then I could see a title change here. But I'm still predicting a Judgment Day win. The Field of Six has been set for the Men's Chamber match with the winner challenging Seth Rollins for the World Heavyweight title at WrestleMania. Drew McIntyre, Randy Orton, LA Knight. What the hell was that? Bobby Lashley, Kevin Owens, and Logan Paul. I scared the shit out of me. And Logan Paul. Another stacked lineup. You could take out Lashley, Owens, and Logan Paul. They're not winning. That leaves McIntyre, Orton, and Knight. All three have a chance. LA Knight has the lowest chance of the three. I'm still pulling for a U.S. title match at WrestleMania with Knight and Paul. And they could have one eliminate the other inside the chamber to light the fuse for a feud. I think we get the eventual Owens and Logan Paul rematch, because they're going to have a rematch for the U.S. title, I believe, and I think they could do that on TV. They don't have to hold off until WrestleMania to do that. To me, it comes down to McIntyre and Randy Orton. Randy has no obvious opponent right now for WrestleMania. Him wrestling Cody for the WWE title is something I would like to see. Maybe that could even be a SummerSlam match. But to do that, they need to be on the same brand. But with Cody challenging Roman at WrestleMania, if he wins the title, that's going to open up a big hole on Raw that needs to be filled. Orton would certainly fill it if he won the Chamber. They would effectively be swapping brands. That's why I can't count him out completely, but I'm going to stick to my guns and say that Drew McIntyre wins the Chamber. And Drew McIntyre is the correct choice to win the Chamber. This man has been killing it recently. I love the work that he's been doing. His story arc, I mean, it just dovetails perfectly into WrestleMania, getting one more shot. I think we get him, Seth, and Sami Zayn, I think, is going to ultimately find his way into that World Heavyweight title match. You know, they've got 6 weeks of television, 6 weeks or so, to figure out a way to get him in there. It just feels to me like that's what they're building to. I mean, they could always take someone like Sami and stick him in there with Gunther at WrestleMania, who needs an opponent now that Brock Lesnar is not going to be on the show. Some people thought maybe Bron Breakker would take that spot. Now we know that's not going to happen because Bron Breakker is officially a member of the SmackDown roster. So Sami Zayn would be on the short list, I think, of potential opponents for Gunther at WrestleMania. You put him on there, you put Andrade on there. I'm still going to stick Chad Gable on there because I got my fingers crossed. I'm holding out hope, even though it doesn't look good. But I still feel like Sami is going to work his way into that world title match. You know, all this stuff about how I'm a contender and I believe that I can be a world champion. It's not about the Intercontinental title for him. You know, been there, done that. If they're working that story, it's all about the World Heavyweight title and him trying to find his way into that match. So I got Drew for the win in the men's chamber. I am wondering, though, I wonder if they would close the show with Rhea Ripley over the men's chamber. I feel like it'll be the men's chamber, I feel like, but there's a chance they could potentially close out the show with Rhea Ripley against Nia Jax, which would be, you know, on the one hand, it would be quite the choice, but as over as I'm sure Rhea's going to be there in that stadium, I don't know. Is it all that unrealistic to think they might do that? I don't think it is. Cody Rhodes and Seth Rollins, they will be on the show, but as guests on the Grayson Waller Effect. They showed Waller and Paul Heyman speaking backstage on SmackDown Friday night. We couldn't hear what they were talking about. I expect some kind of bloodline appearance. Will it be Roman Reigns or The Rock, though? Yeah, I could see it. Especially if this tag team match is still in play for WrestleMania, they could shoot the angle for it at the chamber. Remember, the officials down there had asked WWE months ago if they thought that there was a chance that they could get The Rock for this show. What a kick in the teeth it would be to them now that Rock is actually back if they don't get him to show up. They already have no Roman Reigns title defense. They have no Seth Rollins title defense. They lost CM Punk. It's a long flight, but they could be a surprise. I don't know if you saw the video Roman Reigns posted on his Twitter. It was him and Paul Heyman. They filmed it at TV the other night. It was just him sitting on the couch backstage. Paul Heyman's behind him, admiring him as he always does. And Roman asks him, he goes, wise man, you know, where's the chamber being held? And Heyman tells him, Perth, Australia, my tribal chief. And Roman's eyes, they nearly bugged out of his head when he asked. He goes, I have to go down there? Heyman told him, no. You could see the relief wash over his face. For a second there, that man thought he might actually have to take his ass to work. He almost had a heart attack. But it takes balls to have your champion tweet out a message to people telling them to buy tickets, and he had a Ticketmaster link in there. Buy your tickets while in the same message telling you he's not going to be on the show. Which makes me think he is going to be on the show. Which is still crazy, though, that they would tell you he's not going to be and still ask you to buy tickets. Per ESPN, there was an article this week with the headline, UFC and WWE partner on a 5-year deal to bring events to Anaheim. The WWE and UFC, who merged last year into one company, the publicly traded TKO Group, have signed a joint live event partnership with Sports and Entertainment District OC Vibe that will bring multiple events from both promotions to the Honda Center in Anaheim, California over the next 5 years, according to officials who talked to ESPN. Beginning this year, the UFC and WWE will hold at least 3 events each at the arena through 2028, including the possibility of UFC pay-per-views and fight night cards and WWE Raw or SmackDown television programs. The deal does not specifically call for the UFC and WWE to hold events on back-to-back days or in the same week, although it is a possibility. The deal is the first of its kind since TKO formed officially last September, and it could be indicative of how the new company will package the UFC and WWE together to jurisdictions and tourism authorities in the future. Both promotions have been actively looking for partners for these types of arrangements across the world, where local governments or private companies will pay to bring either one or both to their respective regions. On Saturday, the UFC will hold UFC 298 at the Honda Center. 2 days later, on Monday, WWE hosts Raw in the same building. That was purely a coincidence, but TKO Group is capitalizing on it by offering ticket packages for both events, as well as VIP tickets to watch the UFC event with WWE stars Bianca Belair and Montez Ford. Yeah, those two have been doing a lot of media because they have a new reality show on Hulu, which I have not seen, but they've been doing a lot of press for it. Anaheim is a strong market for WWE. They have almost 11,000 tickets sold for Raw tomorrow night at the Honda Center. I can't even say the word Honda now without hearing John Cena's voice in my head. And the Wall Street Journal reported this week that Comcast and Paramount have had early talks about possibly merging their Peacock and Paramount Plus streaming services together. Talks are said to be in the spitballing stage right now. Peacock had 31 million subscribers at the end of last year, while Paramount Plus had over 63 million. And Peacock is, of course, the home of WWE, but how something like this might affect things remains to be seen. I smell a price increase. This week's episode is sponsored by ExpressVPN. You know, I dropped my phone the other day. I almost had a heart attack because I don't drop stuff. Not usually. I keep my phone in a protective case anyway because for the money I paid for this thing, I can buy a $20 case to keep it safe. Going online to do your banking or to buy things and give your credit card information out, or really to do anything, without using ExpressVPN would be like using your smartphone without a case. All it takes is one drop on concrete and you're going to wish you had that protection. Trust me. You need a VPN because every time you connect to a network that's not encrypted, which could be anywhere outside your home really, you have to assume that your data is not secure. Anyone with enough know-how on that same network can easily steal your personal data. That includes passwords and important financial details. It doesn't take much. Any kid who looks up how to do it online can do it. And your data is valuable. Hackers can make out with up to $1,000 per person selling your information on the dark web. So now that you know you need to be using a VPN, let me tell you why you should be using ExpressVPN. Because it creates an encrypted tunnel between your device and the internet, so hackers can't steal your data. So you know it's secure. It's also easy to use. You just fire up the app, you click one button, and that's it. You're protected. And it works on all devices like phones, laptops, tablets, and more. That ease of use, that's what I like most personally about ExpressVPN. I don't have to think about it. I just click a button and it takes care of the rest for me. That's important to me because my life is online. All of our lives really are online, personally and professionally. And the last thing that I want is someone snooping around and stealing my information. It's not their information, it's mine. And I'd like to keep it that way. So secure your online data today by visiting expressvpn.com/solomonster. That's expressvpn.com/solomonster. And you can get an extra 3 months free. expressvpn.com/solomonster. AEW has nearly 16,000 tickets sold for the Greensboro Coliseum for Revolution. It's about 300 shy of a sellout. And you can credit one thing for that. That is Sting's retirement match, which was made official on Dynamite. It will be Darby Allin and Sting defending their AEW World Tag Team titles against the Young Bucks. This after the Bucks beat Top Flight and then declared themselves number one contenders. See, I gave them 6 months before they completely abandoned the rankings again. But at this rate, it may be a lot sooner than that. Darby Allin, in his promo on the Bucks on Wednesday, basically what he did here, he copy and pasted the criticism of the Bucks from places like Twitter and Jim Cornette's podcast, talking about how they turned all elite wrestling into all friendship wrestling and put people like Brandon Cutler on TV, and how at the time he came into the company, he said, thank God there was one EVP with brains, and I'm not talking about Kenny Omega, which kind of buried Omega there in a way. I don't think that was the intent, but in a way he kind of did. But he was talking about Cody Rhodes, which led to Cody chants. They designed this promo knowing that people would chant for Cody Rhodes, the man headlining WrestleMania, who has absolutely nothing to do with AEW anymore. You know, one thing that Tony Khan is very good at, I have to give him a lot of credit for this, is promoting the other brand, whether it's through his Twitter meltdowns or stuff like this. If this AEW thing doesn't work out, maybe the other Khan could hire him to work in their promotions department. I think he'd be very good at it. I thought the angle that they shot at the end of the show last week was sufficient, honestly, to put heat on the Bucks. It was a great old-school wrestling angle that they did when they beat down Sting and they beat down Darby. I mean, think about it. They beat up Darby and they bloodied him up. They beat up Sting. They beat up Sting's kids. They came out this week with Darby's dried blood still on their suits. Like, I don't even understand why this was necessary. But they've also added a match between Konosuke Takeshita and Will Ospreay, who has officially finished up with New Japan, and he will be starting full-time with them at Revolution. I love it. I mean, that's going to be an amazing match. And I suspect that it will be the start, at least, of a babyface turn, or a turn away from the Callis family for Will Ospreay. But their rationale for doing it was ridiculous. Callis is doing a promo in the back. He's got Hobbs with him. He's got Takeshita with him. He's standing there, and he says, well, there's no competition for Takeshita, so he decided to look within the family. And it was Don Callis' own idea to take two of his own guys and have them fight each other with the idea that we win either way, because when it's over, we're all going to be on the same page. Which you know they're not going to be. Why he would willingly jeopardize the health of either man when he doesn't have to by putting them in a match against each other is something that cannot be explained. But this is what they came up with to get Ospreay on the show. I'm glad it's happening. It's completely nonsensical, but I'm happy we get to see it. That could be the match of the year easily. It's only February, and that could easily be the match of the year. Samoa Joe was on television on Wednesday. He eviscerated Hangman Page and Swerve Strickland on the microphone. That will be a three-way for the AEW World title. Swerve should not win the title yet. Joe deserves a longer run with that belt, and they have the perfect out by having Hangman eat the pin. It doesn't even have to be a pin. He could voluntarily tap out if there was some sort of double submission spot where Hangman thought Joe might tap to Swerve, and he's trapped, he can't go anywhere. So in a moment of panic, what does he do? He gives up first. Right? I mean, there's a few different ways they could go with that, but the point is, Hangman Page, this character, has become so obsessed with Swerve not being the champion that it's more important to him than winning the title itself. So he will be the reason why Swerve does not win. And you save Swerve from taking the loss himself, and that sets him up for a rematch down the road later in the year. They have the perfect out. Someone in the YouTube comments asked me, how does it make sense that Hangman is even in the match when Swerve already beat him two straight? Why wouldn't it be Swerve and Joe one-on-one? It doesn't. It doesn't make sense. But they probably don't want to put the belt on Swerve yet. So this was their way of getting around it. I mean, look, if we go to Revolution and Swerve Strickland wins the AEW World title, then I have no fucking idea why there was the need to make this a three-way. You're absolutely right. But it's pretty clear to me that they're probably not putting the belt on Swerve just yet. And so this was their way of kind of getting around that. Hangman could be the fall guy in this match. Right? Better to have Hangman lose the match than Swerve. So I think that's why they're doing it this way. But I agree with you. I mean, Hangman does not deserve the shot. Not before Swerve. You know, they did a third match between them, and they went to a time limit draw. That still doesn't mean Swerve should not be ranked ahead of Hangman. And I think technically he is. I think they had him at one and Hangman at two. But again, trying to make sense of that is pointless. These are all things, by the way, that if WWE had done them, and the reason I point these out, and it drives people nuts, it drives the AEW fans nuts, and this is something I was on full display for me this week, because if I tell you the hate that I got coming out of that SmackDown stream I did on Friday night from all the Rock fans, all the crybaby Cody fans that Rock talks about in storyline, right? You have an equal number of them on the other side. And there were some who actually, look, they were respectful and civil, and they pleaded their case, and they thought I was being dismissive with some stuff, and you know what? Fair enough. But then you have the dopes, you have the fucking weirdos, and there are a lot of them, who clearly also don't listen to the podcast. It's very clear to me when they say certain things, they don't actually listen to what I say. But the amount of just goober messages that I had to read this week from people when it comes to that, you got them on both sides. The AEW fans are no better. They're just as bad. And the slightest criticism sets them off. And the reality is this. If I didn't point these things out, because it does drive me nuts, that's why I point them out. If I didn't point this shit out, people would rightfully come at me and say, you know what, if this were WWE, you would point out that this doesn't make sense and that doesn't make sense and where's the logic in this and where's the logic in that. And you're right. You're absolutely right. But it drives them completely insane. And they will twist themselves into a pretzel trying to explain why it's fine and why it all makes sense. But they're really no better than the WWE tribalists. But for all the times I pointed it out with Vince's booking, I'm going to point it out with Tony. It doesn't get a pass. Some of the shit just doesn't make sense. Also on the Revolution card, I digress. Also on the Revolution card, Christian Cage is going to defend his TNT title. We just don't know yet against who. Adam Copeland and Daniel Garcia, they wrestled to decide who would be the number one contender until Killswitch and Nick Wayne ran in, and that caused a no contest. And then Christian bashed Copeland's brains in with a concerto, which usually means someone is taking some time off. We're so close to the pay-per-view, though, that would mean Garcia would get the shot, and then maybe they're going to hold off on Christian and Copeland for Double or Nothing. But it's possible that maybe Copeland misses a week, and then boom, there he is again. And because of the no contest, like with Hangman and Swerve with their draw, Tony Khan makes it a three-way. Doing a three-way for the world title and the TNT title on the same show, I think, is a bit much. I don't like that. But if they want to move the TNT title onto a young guy and not just have 50-year-old Adam Copeland win the belt back for a second time, I can't hate on that. I mean, Garcia has been getting more over with their audience. I wouldn't mind Garcia getting a run as TNT champion. I'm just not a fan of making that match a three-way if that's the plan. Eddie Kingston is going to put his Continental title on the line against Bryan Danielson. Danielson's year so far has been just ridiculous. This man wrestled Okada at the Tokyo Dome. He beat Yuji Nagata on Collision, then Echeserro on Collision, then he lost to Zack Sabre Jr. in Japan. Now he's wrestling Jun Akiyama on Collision next Saturday. Akiyama being one of Kingston's idols. Toni Storm defends her women's world title against Deonna Purrazzo, and Orange Cassidy defends the international title against Roderick Strong. Cassidy and Matt Taven, they main evented Dynamite in a Texas death match. They just sort of threw that out there, that these two would be having a Texas death match after Taven and Bennett spiked him on his head on Collision. Apparently that was enough to make this a Texas death match, but they went out there and they tried their best to live up to the stipulation. Both men bled. Taven took this hellacious bump over the top rope through a table that was leaned up against the announce desk, so it fucking snapped in half when he collided with it. Now Cassidy defends against Roddy at Revolution, and Roddy has to win that title. The Undisputed Kingdom is on life support right now. There can be no other outcome other than Roderick Strong winning the international title at Revolution. And last but not least here on the AEW front, QT Marshall has been hired back per Fightful. He will be in his old executive role as vice president, but he will no longer be wrestling for AEW. He does, however, have permission to wrestle outside of AEW, pretty much anywhere except WWE. QT Marshall, the George Costanza of All Elite Wrestling, quits on a Friday. On Saturday, he realizes I've made a terrible mistake. Shows back up to work on Monday like nothing ever happened, hoping no one will notice. And we have more on the fallout from Scott D'Amore's firing from TNA I know Dave's batting average this week was pretty low, but he did say that DeMore's offer to buy the company from Anthem, because after he was made aware of the fact that his time there, he was on borrowed time, he did try to make an offer to buy TNA away from Anthem, and which was rejected, by the way, clearly. He says that the offer came after their January 20th and 21st tapings in Florida. He says sources on both sides say DeMore knew well before the Hard to Kill pay-per-view that not only was he being let go, but Ed Nordholm, the former president of Impact Wrestling before DeMore took over in that role, he too is no longer a part of TNA, although he's an Anthem guy, so he still works for Anthem, just no longer on the wrestling side. So that means DeMore knew that he was a dead man walking when he went out there after the Will Ospreay-Josh Alexander match on television. He cut that impassioned promo in the middle of the ring. Now we know why he was so fired up, because he knew he was a goner. He knew this was the last time he was going to be able to address the TNA audience. Meltzer noted that DeMore and Nordholm both being gone from TNA are directly related, as Nordholm is the one who was said to have pushed hard for Anthem to spend on signing people like CM Punk and Will Ospreay, neither of whom ended up actually signing with TNA. So you have the two men responsible for pushing Anthem to spend more and help grow the brand being dismissed at the same time. That is not a coincidence. Now, Fightful published a letter this week that members of the TNA roster sent to Anthem CEO Len Asper, as well as Scott DeMore. In the letter, they expressed their belief that DeMore is the best person to be leading TNA. And that letter reads as follows. Len and Scott, TNA / Impact is not just our employer and the company for which we work. It is a family that each of us has grown to love and cherish and trust with our bodies and our careers, a family for which we feel deeply and that desire above all else to protect. We are deeply saddened by the decision to remove Scott DeMore from the TNA Impact family. Scott is a brilliant wrestling mind that has guided this company and has it positioned to take the next step upward in our industry. Scott is also so much more than this. He is a trusted friend, confidant, teacher, advisor, brother, and mentor to so many within the TNA family. Scott has been the heart of the TNA family for over two decades. Len and Anthem have been instrumental in supporting and building this company back from the ground up. The contributions of Len and Anthem have never gone unnoticed by anyone in the company, and we want to make sure Len knows this. TNA, simply put, would not have survived without Len and Anthem. Not just financially, but with the undying faith in Scott and us to revive the company that was on the brink of death. Len and Anthem are the foundation that TNA has been able to build upon. We would not have made it back to this point without both of you. Fans know this, and the TNA family knows this. We come to you to voice our concern for TNA, our family, and its future and direction. We, like you, wish to safeguard what we have all worked and sweat and bled for to build. We want TNA to continue to grow and to continue to be an enviable place for all professional wrestlers to work. We understand and appreciate that professional wrestling at its core is a business and that the company must provide a fiscally responsible, financially viable product. At the same time, professional wrestling is uniquely situated. The business of professional wrestling is so much more than balance sheets, downloads, and ratings. The wrestling business is and must be its people, its characters, and its storylines. That is to say, there is no wrestling business without the wrestling creative vision and the right people bringing the creative vision to life. To thrive, a wrestling company must have both an eye toward business decisions and its fingers on the pulse of creative decisions and the ever-changing appetite of our fans. It is in light of this concern and our desire to uphold the high standards of TNA that we offer this letter. It is our desire to have a dialogue with you and with the company in an effort to protect the present and future of TNA for you, for Anthem, for the fans, and for professional wrestlers. We feel strongly that a wrestling person needs to be intimately involved at a high level to ensure that the amazing company we have all built and the product that we have provided to our fans continues to grow and flourish. It is our opinion that the best possible person for that role was, is, and will be Scott. We recognize that we do not necessarily know all the facts or details around the decision to remove Scott. In life, there is always the rumors, the opinions, and somewhere in between the truth. We rarely get to know which is which. It remains our hope and desire that everyone can set aside the past few days and any hurt feelings or unkind words that may have been exchanged, and meet to discuss a path forward that preserves the TNA family we all hold so dearly. We remain steadfast and hopeful that this letter can be a first step to opening and keeping open a productive productive lines of communication to ensure TNA's family continues to be a wonderful, unique place to work for years to come. We ask and implore you both to come together and create a resolution that will reunite this family once again. We look forward to hearing from you and continuing this dialogue. Signed, your TNA family. So Mike Johnson is saying that that was just a portion of the letter. The full thing is actually longer than that. And there were a lot of people upset that the letter got leaked. I'm glad it did. I'm glad it was leaked. It shows just how much support Scott D'Amore has, you know, from that TNA roster, and how well-liked and well-respected he is. I don't know how persuasive this letter is going to be to Anthem, or if it's going to move the needle at all. I don't think it's going to result in Anthem bringing back Scott D'Amore to his old job. It should, though, because they fucked up. And look, they're right when they say in the letter that, look, we, and by we, the fans as well, we don't know all the details of what went into the decision. We have heard that it had to do with the fact that, again, D'Amore and maybe Ed Nordholm were pushing for more money to be spent or a bigger budget so that they can really try to grow and expand this brand. And clearly that didn't seem to align with what Anthem had in mind. And that led to this fracture. If there were other reasons involved, there could have been a very good reason why he was let go. But again, if it was something salacious, or if it was something like, the first thing you think of when you hear something like this is, Scott D'Amore was fired? What the fuck? Especially after the month that they just had. Something must have happened, right? That's just your natural instinct. Especially with the stuff that we've heard recently when it comes to wrestling in the news. You think, something must have happened. He did something. He said something. There's something. There's some legal matter at play here. They had to get rid of this guy. And by all accounts, that doesn't seem to be the case here. So I think they fucked up, and they should fix their mistake. Scott D'Amore did a lot of positive things for TNA. He built up a lot of goodwill. Now, let's not get carried away and act like the company was putting up numbers like they did 15 years ago. Their audience is still relatively small. Their audience is a fraction of what it used to be. But I don't think you can see the kind of growth D'Amore was looking for without a better television deal. And I don't see how replacing Scott D'Amore with Anthony Chacon or anyone else is going to change that. Was Scott D'Amore the one holding them back from getting off of Access TV for a bigger network? Not only was he not holding them back from that, by all accounts, he was probably, in his mind anyway, I don't know if he ever had any direct conversations with them about the television aspect of things, but he was probably encouraging it and hoping for it and pushing for it. He wanted to try to get them to spend more. Anthem doesn't want to spend more. And until that attitude changes, nothing they do is going to move the needle much. Even under D'Amore, they had a good month. January was, up until a point, January was a very good month for TNA until this happened. A lot of excitement for the TNA product. But they're in the same spot that they have been in for the past several years. But that's not on Scott D'Amore. That's on Anthem. Now, Friday morning, after the Observer dropped, and Dave had that item, it was one line in the Observer that Tommy Dreamer has taken over as the head of creative for TNA. Dreamer, who has a regular recurring role on Busted Open Radio, he was on, and they informed him that he was trending on social media after the report came out. And Dreamer said, I'm so glad that people know things about my life that I don't know. Everything is staying intact how it was before, with myself, Robert Evans, and Delirious from Ring of Honor. So there are no changes. And I purposely made sure that that was a thing. So whoever reported about myself and my life, thank you. But as someone who has been doing the same stuff for the entire time I've been there, nothing has changed. Thanks for the promotion. I hope I get a raise with this fictitious position, because if I was the head of creative, you know Moose is losing the title to me at whatever the next show is. Book myself on time, brother. Mike Johnson added a little bit more to this. He had a rumor killer report on PW Insider, and he did confirm with multiple sources that Meltzer's report is 100% incorrect. Here is what he has been able to confirm. The existing TNA creative team, which is Tommy Dreamer, R.D. Evans, and Hunter Johnston, Delirious, formerly from Ring of Honor, that team is going to remain in place, and they are going to continue to work as they did before Scott D'Amore got fired. The existing team is supported by Gail Kim, who was already one of the top officials behind the scenes. She does a lot of different things for them. So now she could add creative to that list of responsibilities. Not that she didn't have input into that before, but now she'll be supporting that team. Jorge Barbosa has also joined the creative process. Yeah, he has been a senior producer for Anthem for a long time. He was the person behind all of the excellent Fight Network diary documentaries that focused on TNA personalities and MMA personalities. And supposedly he has a great reputation creatively from the different projects that he has worked on. That doesn't necessarily mean that when it comes to pro wrestling, he'll be a great creative mind, but he has been added to the process. And so Tommy Dreamer is not the one in charge. Then who is? And Johnson has confirmed that Ariel Schnerer will be overseeing all TNA content going forward and will be working in conjunction with the new TNA president. So it will be Schnerer who will have the last word on any talent and creative decisions, although Anthony Chacon, the new president, will be the top of the food chain there, so to speak. Schnerer is the former general manager of the Fight Network. He has been involved in TNA since Anthem acquired the company. Apparently, he's appeared on TV from time to time as Dr. Ariel, but behind the scenes is where he has really been important. He manages the distribution of TNA across Anthem, and he was involved in securing their television deal with DAZN and a number of TNA streaming deals for Roku and Pluto TV. So technically speaking, if anybody was to be considered the head of creative going forward, it would be him. It would not be Tommy Dreamer. There you go. Short and sweet. That's the key news of the week. Definitely a slower news week than last week, which is good. Get a little bit of a breather. It's also good because I got to pluck out more of your questions and you got some good ones for me. So let's jump into the mailbag here. You can always email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. I have to start with this. I got this amazing email from Yusuf. That I just had to share with all of you to show you the global reach that this show has. He said, "This is going to be random as hell, but it's too funny not to share. I think you'll appreciate it. I was listening to the latest Sound Off, and I heard you mention Faisal from Kuwait and how he went to the latest New Japan show. I'm from Kuwait too, so it's always nice to see that there is another Sound Off listener from my country. Anyway, I was also browsing Instagram at the same time, and I come across stories posted by one of the accounts that I'm following. It was images from the crowd at the latest New Japan show. I noticed the account's name is Faisal. I'm like, wait a minute, what the fuck? Is it seriously the same dude I was just listening to Solomonster talk about? Lo and behold, it turns out it was indeed the same Faisal. Funny enough, him and I both already followed each other on Instagram, because we are part of a photography enthusiast community, but we've never actually met. I reached out to him, and we both could not believe it. That coincidence absolutely cracked me up. I just wanted to share that little story, and hopefully it amuses you as much as it did me. Between Faisal, myself, and my brothers, I would say you have a sizable Sound Off army forming in Kuwait." See, I love hearing stuff like that. And it's weird. I've gotten stories from people before who live in other parts of the world, and maybe they just don't think there's a big wrestling community, or there is, but, you know, they wouldn't think there's too many people listening to podcasts or this podcast, who end up, like, making new friends just through wrestling, because they don't have anybody else to talk to when it comes to wrestling, and they make friends through this show. Like, all kinds of stories like that, and I love stuff like that. So thank you to Yusuf for sharing that. That's awesome. Binder from Milwaukee. "Among the many questions and scenarios people probably email you about when it comes to Cody and Roman and Rock, let's add another one while we're at it. Cody versus Roman on night 2 of WrestleMania. The Rock tries to help Roman win, but it backfires somehow. Cody gets the win, poses, pyro, all that stuff. After, Roman confronts The Rock, saying he screwed him. Then Roman Solo and Jimmy start beating down The Rock. Cody, being the ultimate good guy he is, comes back out to save The Rock, starts to leave after clearing the ring, only for Rock to stop him from leaving, shakes his hand, and raises his arm to endorse him. This could help turn Rock babyface again to start building up to Rock against heel Roman for WrestleMania 41. Look, I mean, that's as good as any other scenario that I've heard people, you know, pitching. I don't, the aspect of it I don't think is realistic. I don't know that Rock would want to put himself in a position where he has to be saved. You know, is Rock okay with being beaten down and having to be saved by Cody Rhodes? I wouldn't think he wants to be saved by anybody. I think it's more a case where, again, they're either in on it together and he plays the role of hero to prevent the bloodline from screwing him over for the second time. Or if there is no big conspiracy between the two of them, it just works out where Rock, you know, if there's some kind of falling out during the match, he'll again fight him off on his own. I don't think Rock needs anybody to help him. But I think him giving Cody the endorsement at the end and raising his arm, I definitely could see that. I think him giving Cody the endorsement at the very end would be huge. But the part about him being saved, and also, you know, the whole beatdown and everything, I think I got another question about that, but I think that's better to save for a later time anyway. So I don't think it's realistic, but the endorsement, I think we're going to get the endorsement at the end of WrestleMania. Dan from Allentown, Pennsylvania. I know WWE and AEW don't play well together, but there have been a few times where they have been allowed to have some kind of limited crossover, like the John Cena tribute videos a few years ago. If and when Cody finally wins the WWE title, do you think they might allow Dustin Rhodes to come to the ring and celebrate with his brother? I think it would be a cool moment for Dustin to be there with his brother when he finally wins the title that was taken away from Dusty all those years ago. If they really wanted to splurge, Dustin could hop the barricade and help fight off Solo and Jimmy at WrestleMania Night 2, when it looks like Solo and Jimmy might be able to get past The Rock. It's funny. That's funny that you think that they would be able to get past The Rock. Come on now, he's The Rock. He's not going to let that happen. He said, I won't hold my breath, but it would be nice if Dustin could at least be there to celebrate with Cody after his big win. I think it would be nice too, and I think Tony Khan would be open to it. I don't know if WWE would be. I feel like if it was that important to Cody, and he went to Triple H and Nick Khan and said, look, is there something we could work out where if they're open to it, I'd love to have my brother in the front row. I don't see Dustin's not going to get involved and take bumps or anything like that. But just to have him in the front row, even if they didn't acknowledge him, which I think would be very petty. But even if they didn't acknowledge him, I mean, look, they had negative one. They had negative one at WrestleMania last year. They didn't acknowledge him, though, but he was right there in the front row, right? Technically, he's on the AEW roster, right? They have an end. He's on the roster page. He's part of the Dark Order. I think that it would be a very cool thing, because I'm sure Dustin would love to be there. If Tony Khan has the respect for Dustin that I think he does, and Dustin said, look, it would mean a lot to me if I was allowed to at least be there, you know, and they might even acknowledge me. They might even put me on camera. I'm not going to, you know, physically get involved, but I would love to be there. I feel like Tony Khan would be open to it. You know, I mean, I understand the two companies not wanting to work together, and there's bad blood there from Tony Khan's end. He really feels WWE's fucked with him before. Like, I get that, but I think they should work something out. I think it would be cool for him to be there and give his brother the hug when the match is over. I think that would be nice. Jason from Idaho. What if, for John Cena's storyline of not being able to win a match, it keeps going until he decides to have a retirement match and he finally gets a win? Yeah, I think that's very possible. I don't know how many matches he's got left. I don't think he's got many singles matches left in him. So it's the fact that he still hasn't won a singles match in 5 or 6 years, it may just work out that way, where whatever his final match is, he finally picks up a win. Seems plausible to me. Dallas from Minnesota. Since the match between Roman and Rock has no heat, Rock is a big heel now and the fans want Cody to finish the story. Here is my solution. Cody wins the match, and at the end of the match, Rock berates Roman for failing and Rock bottoms him. Jimmy and Solo leave him, and so does Heyman. Roman is out of the bloodline, and thus begins Roman's babyface run /redemption and the build to Rock versus Roman at WrestleMania 41. I would save it for television. Don't take away from Cody's moment by making it all about the bloodline when it's over. If Roman loses, you gotta let the wind breathe. Let the man have his celebration and his pyro and his moment that he didn't have last year. You've got a big SmackDown show then coming up on Friday. You'll pop a huge rating for that show. Shoot the angle on SmackDown. I would save it for there. Don't take away from his moment just to make it all about the bloodline again. Dave from Tucson, Arizona, do you think it's possible for Shawn Michaels to come out of retirement again and face The Rock at WrestleMania on Triple H's behalf? No, I do not. Joshua in North Carolina, what do you know about David Sammartino and why wasn't he more successful? David Sammartino was actually part of one of the more infamous matches in WWF history. That's probably what I remember him most for. If you couldn't figure it out, David Sammartino is the son of former WWE champion Bruno Sammartino, Hall of Famer. I mean, no one is topping Bruno as far as the total number of days or the length of a single title run. What was it, 8 years? 7 or 8 years he was the champion the first time, and then they gave him like another token run. It was just a measly little like 3-year run. You know, just 3 years, that's all. So no one is topping Bruno, but David was his son. And here's the thing about David. He wasn't his father, and that hurt him. There was nothing flashy about him, but there was nothing terribly interesting about him either or charismatic about him. Vince brought him in for one reason. He brought him in because he wanted Bruno around. Bruno stuck around because of his son. He thought he could help get his son a push, right? Not the first time we have a case of, you know, nepotism in wrestling, and it certainly won't be the last. He was looking out for his boy. He thought, okay, if me sticking around and being an announcer and, you know, still doing things which he didn't really want to do, if it might help my son, then fine, I'll do it. Vince wanted Bruno to come out of retirement, which he did for a few matches, which he later said he regretted doing. His last match, I think, was a tag team match with Hulk Hogan, who stood for everything that he didn't. Like, Hogan stood for everything this man hated. And his last match was standing next to him posing after they won. Like, they did a tag match together. It was in, I think, the summer of 87 or something. But Vince got what he wanted out of it. You know, if that meant keeping his son around, then so be it. That's the only reason David wrestled Brutus Beefcake at the first WrestleMania, because it got Bruno involved. David spent most of his time beating prelim guys on the bottom. You know, he never got a real push. The infamous match I was talking about was his last match there. It was in 87. And it was against Ron Shaw. Ron Shaw, it was weird because Ron Shaw did a shoot interview, and I don't know if it was on, maybe it was Hannibal's YouTube channel a few years ago. It wasn't that long ago. And I came across it, and I know a little bit. Ron Shaw, he was an enhancement guy. He was a journeyman wrestler. It was, you know, nothing major. But I looked at him and I said, ah, the guy looks good. You know, he doesn't look haggard or anything like that. I went and I looked up what he used to look like. And somebody had an analogy, and it was actually the perfect analogy. And it was something like Ron Shaw, when he was, I guess he would have been probably, what, in his 30s? Maybe early late 20s, early 30s. When he was in his 30s, he looked like he was in his mid-40s. And now that he's probably close to like 70 or something, he still looks like he could be in his 40s. It's like the aging process slowed down with this guy. He still looks the same, more or less. Good for him. The fact that he's even still alive from that era should be considered an achievement today. The fact that he's still kicking. But it was against Ron Shaw. And David was supposed to beat him, of course, because Ron Shaw always lost. David had other ideas. And he told Shaw before the match, he said, you're going to get me in a bear hug, and I'm going to submit. And that's what happened. He gave up in a bear hug. And the fans, even then, this was in 87, they started chanting bullshit. They announced Shaw as the winner. Gorilla Monsoon was doing commentary. He refused to believe that he submitted. Even after they showed a replay, he refused to believe that David Sammartino gave up. The man is flailing his arms around at the referee. He still would not acknowledge that he submitted. And Gorilla was friends with Bruno. He was trying to protect his boy. He didn't know what was going on. As soon as the match was over and they went to commercial, he sprinted to the back to go find out what the hell happened. But David knew, they're not going to do anything with him. They have him beating the same low-level guys over and over again. He had probably wrestled Ron Shaw, fucking a dozen times at that point. So he took matters into his own hands. It was like a reverse Montreal screwjob. It'd be like if Brett had started furiously tapping out the minute that Shawn Michaels turned him over in the sharpshooter. But after that, he still wrestled sporadically here and there, but that match in 87 was basically the end of his career, at least nationally. He never did anything, of note after that. That was pretty much it. Mark from Massachusetts. Would The Undertaker, let's say he gets the rights to the character and the name, have been successful in New Japan in 2000 and beyond? Yes, absolutely. Back in the day, I think even still to this day, you take an American giant and you put them in Japan, they will get over with that audience. That was commonplace then. And I think it still applies now. Even Albert got over there. Remember Giant Bernard? Albert was not over a day in his life here in the States. He wasn't over as Prince Albert. He wasn't over as A-Train. He wasn't over as Lord Tenzai. But he went to Japan. He became a pretty big star. The Undertaker would have been highly respected if he committed himself to a run there. I think he would have done very well. Maddie from New York. Who are Shawn Michaels' five greatest rivals? I scribbled this down. It's very easy. Bret Hart, Undertaker, Triple H, Chris Jericho, and Razor Ramon. Those are Shawn Michaels' five greatest rivals. Dylan from Toronto, Canada, had a very interesting question. And this one was a little hard, but it was interesting enough I thought I would share it. He says, I've compiled a list of seven wrestling legends that have all had their share of criticism over the years from fans and fellow wrestlers about their questionable in-ring talent and work rate. When the bell rings and it's time to go, in which order would you rank these legends based solely on their in-ring ability? Now, this is not entirely a fair question, because in-ring ability can include your ability to draw money, sell tickets. If we're being really technical about this, in-ring ability can include any number of different attributes. And Hogan would be at the top of that list. And there's none of the other six that are listed here even come close. It would be Hogan, and then everybody would be playing a distant number 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. But if we're going by wrestling holds, if we're going by the ability to, tell a story through the moves, their technical ability, here's how I would rank them from best to worst. Okay, we're going to start with the best, and we're going to work our way down to the worst. He had Mick Foley on this list. I'm going to put Mick Foley at the top of the list. He may not have been the flashiest guy, but Mick could work. He was more of a brawler, but you can't go in there and have great matches with Sting and Vader and Shawn Michaels and Triple H without being able to hold up your end, and he more than did that. So I have Mick Foley at number one. Now, he also has Hulk Hogan and Lex Luger on this list. Hogan and Luger, to me, they're interchangeable. I could go with either one at number two and number three. I'm going to put Hogan at number two. And I'm going to put Luger at number three. The matches that Lex Luger had in the late 80s and the early 90s with Ric Flair and Ricky Steamboat and Barry Windham, and my favorite would probably be the tag team match at Super Brawl. I think the first Super Brawl, it was Sting and Luger against the Steiner Brothers. All those matches were great. Like, all great workers that he was surrounded by, but you still need to be able to work. And I don't think he gets enough credit for his early stuff. You go back and watch Luger's early stuff. There's some real good stuff in there. So I think Hogan number two, who's another one, frankly, who doesn't get maybe as much credit from an in-ring perspective because he didn't have to do too much here in the States. You watch him in other places, Japan, people talk about Japan a lot. You could tell he knew how to work. I mean, he could work more holds and moves into his matches if he wanted to. He tried to be smart about it by not doing more than he had to. And yet still the guy had 10 back surgeries. So it just goes to show you that it doesn't matter. You get in the ring, you take bumps. The human body was not meant to take bumps. So then Luger at number three. I'm going to go Kevin Nash at number four. Shawn Michaels gave him and Sid their best matches. I actually like Nash's no-holds-barred match with Shawn in 96 better than Nash's matches with Bret Hart. And those were very good. I like the Shawn match more. I have Nash at number 4. Number 5, and this is where I struggled. When I got to 5, 6, and 7, I went back and forth a few times. 5, 6, and 7, I'll just lay it out for you now. The names on this list, these are not ranked, but the names he put on his list were Warrior, Goldberg, and Sid. Those are the three remaining names. I'm putting Goldberg at number 5. Like the Warrior, he had a rep for hurting people. Right? Bobby Heenan talked about that. He hurt Bobby Heenan many times. He was a little rough on guys. The thing about Warrior, at least he never ended someone's career. But with Goldberg, I always loved it when he would spear people in half, right? It's still the best spear in the business. Bron Breakker is a worthy successor to the move. Goldberg had an explosiveness that just looked great on TV. That could be a double-edged sword, though, right? Kevin Nash said that Goldberg's first 100 matches or so, he thought it was real, right? Implying that, you know, that first, I don't even know, 100 matches would have been what? A year and a half, maybe his first year, year and a half in the business, he wrestled like he thought it was real. There were a lot of guys who probably didn't like working with the guy because he fucking hurt them. Everybody remembers the Bret Hart match, talked about the Bret Hart match many times. Bret certainly never lets anybody forget about that match. But there was a match that I think of with Goldberg. He had with Meng, where it looked like Meng broke his neck. He slammed him. He dropped this fucking guy straight down on his head. And then as the referee was checking on him to make sure he was okay, Jimmy Hart, who was managing Meng, he jumped up on the top rope. Goldberg grabbed him. Now, the spot was, you've seen Ric Flair get caught by Sting and any number of people when he's on the top rope, right? He slammed the guy down. Seems like a very simple spot, right? All things considered. Well, he grabs Jimmy Hart, and he almost kills this man. Jimmy, like, he threw Jimmy, but he didn't let Jimmy get the rotation so that he can land flat on his back. He just kind of lawn darted him into the mat. And he landed right on his shoulder. Like, he couldn't even do that right. So, I'm not going to put him at the very bottom of the list, and I'll tell you why in a second. But he's pretty fucking low on the list when it comes to his in-ring competency as an in-ring worker. I have him at number 5. Number 6, I have the Ultimate Warrior. Ultimate Warrior would get gassed just running to the ring. But the matches that he had with Rick Rude and Randy Savage, those were top tier. Like, he could pull something out of himself when he was challenged, when he was in there with the right person. But his work was largely terrible. Like, nobody will ever mistake the Ultimate Warrior as a good in-ring worker, except people who grew up a fan of the Ultimate Warrior, who are, you know, their opinion and perception of him is colored by that. And it pains me to rank this man dead last because I like him. I like Sid. But I rank Sid dead last in number 7. I have Sid below the Warrior and below Goldberg. There was something about Sid in his prime. He just had the perfect look and the perfect size for a professional wrestler. I mean, it's why he got over everywhere he went. But most of his matches were the drizzling shits. When he wasn't in the ring with Bret Hart or Shawn Michaels, his matches were the drizzling shits. And what sold him dead last for me on this list over the Warrior, right? At least with the Warrior, if you ask me to name, what are the three best Ultimate Warrior matches? Like, on the spot, name them. I could easily rattle them off. Randy Savage, WrestleMania 7, Rick Rude, SummerSlam 89, and Rick Rude in the cage at SummerSlam 90. Even the match with Hogan at the Sky Dome, WrestleMania 6. That's not nearly as bad as some people make it out to be. If you were to ask me on the spot, quick, name my three favorite or best Psycho Sid or, you know, Sid Vicious matches, what would they be? His best match was against Shawn Michaels at Madison Square Garden when he won the title in 96. After that, I'm drawing a blank. I got nothing. He may have had some good tag team matches when he was doing the Skyscrapers thing early in his career. Again, I don't know offhand. I'd have to go back and watch him. I just, there's nothing else that he ever did that, you know, work rate wise as a match ever measured up to me, to that Survivor Series match. He had some good ones, a lot of decent ones, but like I'm talking matches that have stood the test of time. I'm drawing a blank. Even the rematch that him and Sean had at the Alamo Dome, I don't remember being nearly as good. And Sean working that match with the flu, that may have had something to do with it. He was sick as a dog that day. But with Sid, though, like Goldberg and Warrior and these guys, it wasn't about work rate. Like, the question he asked me was about work rate. That's what we're talking about here, right? The moves, the ability to put together an interesting and fun match. But you got to understand, like, they were a product of their time. And so back then, especially in WWF, more so than the NWA, you know, with Vince, it was always about a show. It was about the characters, the larger-than-life characters. It wasn't about work rate. It wasn't about all the great matches that the Horsemen would have or the, you know, Flair would have and stuff like that. They were two totally different promotions, two totally different things. Back then, work rate was not what got these guys over. And they were all over. They were all over. Warrior was over. Goldberg was over more than most, frankly, in the history of the business. Even though it was a short period of time, he was over like nobody's business in WCW. Sid was over pretty much everywhere he went. What got them over was their look, their presence, their size, their charisma. Sid and Warrior had the wackiest promos. Goldberg had no promos. But he had a charisma, like his charisma didn't shine through his words. He just had a certain presence about him. People thought this guy was a fucking badass. That's what got them over. That's what drew them money. At least for a short period of time. So it's interesting just to compare the way things were then to the way things are now. Now things were a lot more, you know, work rate oriented and, oh, you know, they botched this spot, they botched that spot. You have all these spots that people do with all these dives and all these intricate moves. And yes, some of them look cool, but like you just get fatigued by watching it and it hits you one day. You're sitting there going, what am I watching here? Am I watching a gymnastics routine or am I watching a wrestling match between two people who are trying to fucking kill each other? Right? Isn't that the essence of what pro wrestling is supposed to be? Well, I may think that, but everybody has their own perspective on what pro wrestling is supposed to be. That's why people argue with each other and scream at each other online, because they all have different ideas about what wrestling should be, what makes money and what doesn't. That's the beauty of it, and that's also, frankly, the toxicity of it. Comes from all these different viewpoints and all these different opinions. Anyway, keep emailing me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Good shit, as always. Follow me on Twitter, @solomonster. We just hit 35,000 on there, so thank you. We also hit 78,000 recently on YouTube, so thank you for that as well. I'm going to be live with you after Raw this coming Monday, the final Raw before Elimination Chamber, live on Wednesday after Dynamite, probably live on Friday as well. Friday is a taped SmackDown. The results are already in. I haven't even looked yet, frankly, but they taped it in advance because they're going to be traveling to Australia. So I'll probably be live after SmackDown because Rock and Roman were there for the live show, which means they'll probably be on the tape show on Friday as well. And then let me know what you guys think about my plan for the chamber next Saturday. I'm thinking 12, 1 o'clock Eastern, lunchtime, maybe. We'll go live, talk about the show. You guys chime in and let me know. I'll see you for 8:50 next Sunday of the Solomonster Sounds Off. Be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week, and we'll do it all over again next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonster Sounds Off.
Rock was out there tonight, and he can talk about the Cody crybabies all he wants to, and I know there's a decent amount of people out there who agree with what he said on the show tonight.
Rock is right. All the Cody crybabies ruined.
Oh, the Cody crybabies, they ruined the match.
You're going to get Rock and Roman at some point. You're probably going to get it next year. The match is going to happen. It's not going to happen this year because guess what? It's not the time for that match to happen this year. For all the people saying Cody crybabies, I'm seeing just as many on the other side go, oh, it should be The Rock in there with Roman Reigns. Oh, you Cody fans, you ruined it. You ruined it. It was the right move to make. Deal with it.
The Solomonster Sounds Off. Each week, bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow the Solomonster on Twitter @Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Solomonster Sounds Off.